submitted. We'll hear argument next in number 86327, Mullins Coal Company versus the director of the OWCP. Mr. Solomon, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the Black Lung Benefits Act is a federally based workers' compensation program which provides benefits on account of total disability or death of a coal miner due to black lung disease. Hundreds of thousands of claimants have been awarded billions of dollars in benefits in this program by proving their entitlement to these benefits under a regulation which is called the interim presumption. Since its inception 15 years ago, the two agencies which promulgated and have administered this presumption, the Social Security Administration, and after them the Department of Labor, have required proof of an invocation fact by a preponderance of the relevant evidence. The Fourth Circuit, in its divided opinion below, strikes down the preponderance rule for invocation of this presumption and replaces it with a new rule, which requires invocation on virtually any evidence at all, in isolation from the record, and whether or not that evidence is reliable and accurate. The Fourth Circuit's rule is, we think, unprecedented in the context presented. It effectively strips claim defendants of the right to answer critical evidence where it is most significant in the analysis of the case. We think it stands for the proposition that one party's proof in an important point in the case is simply better than another's. The question that's presented here for this Court is whether, in the invocation of this presumption, the claimant must establish invocation by a preponderance of the evidence. We think that he must, and we think so for two reasons. First, because the Secretary of Labor has consistently and over a long period of time required claimants, through the Secretary's interpretation of his regulation, to establish invocation by a preponderance of the evidence. And secondly, and perhaps more importantly, because we think Congress has spoken on this issue as well through the Administrative Procedure Act, and through the Administrative Procedure Act has compelled a holding that the invocation of a presumption of this sort can only be established in an APA proceeding by a preponderance of the evidence.
Mr. Solomons, I'm a little unclear how this argument you're making squares with what the SG tells us is the true doubt rule that's applied in these cases.
Well,
I'd like you to tell me whether you are suggesting, in effect, or implicitly asking us to say there isn't any such thing as a true doubt rule.
Well,
would that be the effect of agreeing with you on this burden of proof question, which seems to me a little different from the question of what the trier of fact should consider in the way of evidence? Aren't you going beyond that?
Well, I think we're going just a little bit beyond the true doubt rule. I think it's important for the Court to recognize that the true doubt rule is a rule which is very rarely applied in these cases. It has been applied, and I think largely without contest, in a case where there, in the invocation analysis, are two absolutely equal pieces of evidence. And the administrative law judge at that point has been permitted in the past to say, I will resolve these doubts in favor of the claimant. The precise meaning of the true doubt rule, and that is not a troubling rule. We do not think that the rule is precisely in accord with the Administrative Procedure Act, because we think under the Administrative Procedure Act, the claimant is required to prove, at least in the invocation analysis, an invocation of this presumption is a very easy task, that his evidence is just a tiny bit better.
Well, do we even have to decide in this case whether there is such a thing as a true doubt rule and how and the burden of persuasion issue that you're discussing?
Well, I don't think that the court has to decide whether there's a true doubt rule. This was not a, the true doubt rule is not presented in any of these three cases. It was not argued in the Fourth Circuit. It was not argued before an administrative law judge. It just doesn't arise here. Now, I think it would be wrong for me to suggest that what you hold may not affect it, but it is not, I think, something which is here. It's a different question. The true doubt is...
Well, you can't have both ways. You don't want us to judge the reasonableness of your opinion, then, as the government has argued in its brief on this point, by the fact that, after all, when all else fails, you have the true doubt rule. You don't urge us to consider that residual benefit to the claimant as being a part of the whole scheme which we approve.
No, I don't think you have to do that. I think that there are arguments pro and con on the true doubt rule as they may be applied to revise the effect of the Administrative Procedure Act in these cases. These arguments have not been made to the court except in footnotes. I'm not prepared to say that the true doubt rule is absolutely wrong. I think it's important in understanding how this presumption works to look at its mechanics just briefly. An award of benefits under this program requires the presence of three statutory elements. First, the claimant must have pneumoconiosis. And pneumoconiosis is a statutory term which is defined somewhat more broadly than the medical term is defined. This pneumoconiosis or this disease must be occupationally caused, and the disease must, in addition to that, result in the total disability or death of the coal miner. Now, when we take this in the context of the interim presumption, what we find is that the invocation of the presumption presumes that all three of the statutory elements are present, but invocation facts generally do not prove that any one of the basic elements of entitlement are present. Now, there is one exception to that where an invocation fact may prove but one element, but there is no invocation fact that proves two. The plain language of the regulation, looking both at the invocation and rebuttal provisions, I think clearly demonstrates that there is a mismatch between invocation facts and rebuttal facts. They are simply not the same. Evidence of the type which is required to establish invocation of the presumption typically, generally, cannot prove rebuttal. But even more importantly, invocation facts are not rebuttal facts. The claimant can establish invocation in the sorts of cases that are presented here by proving but one of several simple medical facts, that he has an X-ray or biopsy, which is indicative of some clinical lung disease, or that he has ventilatory studies or arterial blood gas test data, which when looking simply at the raw data is indicative of a chronic impairment of respiratory function, or that there is physician opinion evidence that the individual is totally disabled by a respiratory or pulmonary impairment. Looking at these four presumption invocation facts, it should be clear that perhaps with the possible exception of the X-ray fact, which could be established, that we're not talking about the basic fundamental elements of entitlement. Those are what's presumed. The invocation facts are different. This is not a bursting bubble presumption. We cannot, within the terms of the presumption, come back in the rebuttal phase and say that the claimant's invocation evidence, his blood gas evidence, or his ventilatory study evidence, is completely false or invalid because it proves nothing. It does not prove, as we are required to do, the negative of one of the three basic elements of entitlement in the case. After invocation, on rebuttal, we're looking at entirely new facts. The invocation facts are left behind us and the focus changes to the presumed facts. And again, there we are required to prove the negative of those presumed facts. Facts are decided only once. You decide invocation facts in the invocation phase. You decide rebuttal facts in the rebuttal phase. There's very little interplay between the two. All we're looking for here, and what we have had for 15 years prior to the Fourth Circuit's decision, is the right to participate in the whole case. We would like to have the opportunity to cross-examine and litigate, not only with respect to rebuttal, but with respect to invocation of the presumption as well, and we think that's only fair. What the Fourth Circuit's rule overlooks is this fundamental mismatch between the invocation and rebuttal facts. And in so doing, it permits evidence which we can prove to be undeniably false to, in many cases, control the outcome of this, of the case.
Total mismatch, at least as to A1, it seems to me you'd be able to rebut the A1.
Well, Your Honor,
the evidence for the A1 presumption.
Justice Scalia, we might be able to, in one circuit. The A1 presumption, if invoked by X-ray evidence, in one circuit has been found rebuttable on the basis of X-ray evidence. In other circuits, and that's the Seventh Circuit, case called Kuhner versus Ziegler Coal Company, which is cited in the briefs, I believe. But in other circuits, the Third Circuit, in a case called Pavesi, we can't do that because we have to prove not only that the claimant doesn't have clinical black lung disease, we've got to prove that he does not have a statutory disease, statutory black lung disease.
Well, I thought that that the rule maybe you're arguing from a different rule. For a different rule in the government, but I thought that the only evidence you were going to allow to come in under A is evidence of the same sort. Or do you want all evidence?
No.
Well, if you only allow evidence of the same sort to come in, then you're still faced to some degree with a mismatch.
Justice Scalia will finish his question at 1 o'clock. When we rose, Mr. Solomons, I believe Justice Scalia was in the process of putting a question to you.
We're making the point that we had to adopt the position you were urging because otherwise you wouldn't have an opportunity to rebut the data under subsection A. But it occurs to me that even if we adopt the position that you espouse, which is essentially the position that the government takes, following the agency's interpretation of its rule, you won't necessarily have a chance to rebut all the evidence that's brought forward under A. For example, under A2, the presumption is established if ventilatory studies establish the presence of a chronic respiratory or pulmonary disease. As I understand the way the agency applies the statute, it will allow, as rebuttal under A, only studies of the same sort. So only ventilatory studies that refute the presence of a chronic respiratory or pulmonary disease would be allowed in. Not an autopsy, for example, under A2. And you'd never be able to get in under B that autopsy, which shows that the ventilatory study was wrong. The way I understand the agency's position, now, am I wrong about their position? And if I'm right about their position, then your position does not create the nice logic that you'd have us believe.
Well, you're right about their position, I am relatively sure, and we agree with it completely. All we're asking for in connection with the invocation inquiry is the opportunity to have like-kind evidence, whether it's X-rays or ventilatory studies, considered with other X-rays and ventilatory studies.
But then you're bound to acknowledge that even under your position, the statute doesn't make a whole lot of sense, that there is some evidence that you're never going to be able to use to refute other evidence, right?
Well, our position is that once you get to the rebuttal inquiry, the evidence that we could be, that is properly considered in the invocation inquiry, doesn't have much of a place once you finally get to rebuttal. It doesn't have much meaning. It's not totally insignificant or irrelevant, but it certainly does not assist in proving a rebuttal fact. And I think what's most important here is to look at the recent Fourth Circuit decisions and their efforts to apply their own rule. In those decisions, which we've cited in our reply brief, it's perfectly clear that the Fourth Circuit is simply not considering ventilatory studies or arterial blood gas studies, or for that matter, even physician opinion evidence relating to the individual's respiratory or pulmonary disease within the context of the rebuttal inquiry. They refuse to do it. And so under the Fourth Circuit's rule, as they have applied it to date, there is simply no place in which contradictory evidence has a place to be considered.
Under your rule, it's just a lesser amount of contradictory evidence that has no place. But you will have to admit that there's some contradictory evidence that will have no place, even under your rule. An autopsy that shows, contrary to a ventilatory study, that there is no respiratory or pulmonary disease. Where do you get that in under your position?
Well, the autopsy is considered in the part of the invocation analysis where you determine whether the autopsy by itself or the autopsy in conjunction with other autopsy reports invokes the presumption. It doesn't have any place in consideration of whether ventilatory studies.
You cannot use it to refute a ventilatory.
No, you cannot.
Anywhere, neither under A nor under B. Well, why is that? That makes no sense.
What you can do with an autopsy study, arguably, is use it in the first instance to determine under the first section of the invocation provision whether the individual has co-worker's pneumoconiosis. That is the place where that kind of evidence is listed and where that kind of evidence ought to be considered. It is a logical and orderly pattern where like-kind evidence is considered with other like-kind evidence in a reasonably logical fashion under the government's rule and under the rule that we're espousing here. We're not suggesting that evidence which is in mismatch ought to be considered together. What we're suggesting is, in the original argument, I think where this line of questioning began, is that the invocation facts which have to be proven by the claimant and the rebuttal facts which we are required to prove create an essential mismatch. And since there is no bursting bubble, once we get past the invocation phase, and this logical and orderly consideration of a burden facts which need to be proven in a burden-shifting presumption, that we reach the point where the evidence makes sense, or the consideration of the evidence makes sense. The preponderance standard for consideration of invocation evidence that's been adopted by the government is the traditional rule for application in a burden-shifting presumption. It's logical and it's fair. It has worked well for many years, and there has been no reason to change it. Indeed, we think the Fourth Circuit had no reason to change it. Congress has had the opportunity to look at it twice and has found no reason to comment on the agency's approach. The rule simply gives all parties their day in court on the whole case, not just a part of it. It does not deny benefits to deserving claimants. Simply requires valid proof of a single fact. We think that the preferable methodology for the resolution of the questions that are presented here is the Administrative Procedure Act. And I say that because it is in the Administrative Procedure Act that Congress has spoken on the issue that's presented in this case. I also say that because we have had a terrible problem in this program with uncertainty in the rules and standards of proof that have applied, that have been applied. There are virtually no two circuits that agree on anything in the application of either the rebuttal or invocation provisions of this presumption or the standards of proof that apply. We think that this is an appropriate place for the Administrative Procedure Act to come in, and indeed the Administrative Procedure Act does apply. Looking specifically at the invocation provisions, in Stedman versus the Securities and Exchange Commission, this Court held, after a comprehensive review of the legislative history of the APA, the proponent of a sanction is required to prove the facts necessary to support it by substantial, that is, by a preponderance of the evidence. Evidence pro and con, similarly evidence which is relevant to other evidence of the same sort, must be weighed, and so says the legislative history. Stedman also holds that where the quantum of proof required to prove a fact is not specified in the underlying statute, that is where the Administrative Procedure Act steps in a program in which it is applicable, to supply the preponderance standard. This holding in Stedman, with no great leap of logic, reasonably and naturally extends to invocation of a burden-shifting presumption like the interim presumption. Invocation and rebuttal under the interim presumption are separate and distinct fact inquiries. Some party bears some burden by some quantity of evidence to prove invocation of this presumption, but it is not specified in the statute. What the statute does specify is that the APA applies. And we think, as in Stedman, that the APA supplies the preponderance rule for invocation as well as for rebuttal of this presumption.
What do you do about what the government points out in footnote 30 of its brief, which is that the APA is excluded in cases where it is otherwise provided by regulations of the Secretary?
Well, the reliance placed there is on Section 422A of the Black Lung Act. Section 422A authorizes the Secretary to write regulations which deviate from the Longshore Act. I do not think that the Secretary's claim, and it has been rejected by every circuit, and it's been rejected by Congress. When they really need an exemption from the APA and the Black Lung Program, they've gone to Congress to get it. And so obviously I wonder how strongly they believe that, in fact, Section 422A provides them with the exemption that they request.
It does say that, except as by regulations of the Secretary.
Well, it says the Longshore Act applies, except as is otherwise provided by regulations of the Secretary. I don't know that that necessarily would give the Secretary the carte blanche to pick and choose from among the APA rules that he would like to apply and those which he would not like to apply. Looking at the decisions of this Court, I think that that claim for a supersedure would go far beyond any holding that this Court, or for that matter, that the circuits have ever reached. It's just too broad. Would like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Solomons. We'll hear now from you, Mr. Kellogg.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. Under the regulations at issue here, a miner with 10 or more years of coal mine experience need only establish one of four basic facts in order to create a presumption of compensable disability. For example, he can prove the existence of pneumoconiosis by virtue of certain X-ray biopsy or autopsy evidence, or he can prove a disabling pulmonary impairment by virtue of certain test evidence. Once he establishes the basic fact in question, the burden then shifts to the mine owner or the director to rebut the presumption of compensable disability. The regulations only permit the mine owner to rebut the presumption by establishing either that the miner is not disabled, or that he does not suffer from pneumoconiosis, or that his condition is not caused by coal mine employment. The word establish in the rebuttal provisions has been universally interpreted at the director's urging to mean prove by a preponderance of the evidence. The question presented here is what the burden of proof is on the miner at the initial invocation stage. The regulations there also state that he must establish the basic fact in question. And the director has interpreted the word established there to mean the same thing that it means in the rebuttal portions of the regulations. That is, he must prove the fact in question by a preponderance of the evidence. The regulations on this point are not unambiguous. But what I hope to show is that only the director's interpretation can ultimately be squared with the language of the regulations. I'd like to deal straight away with what appears to be the greatest problem for the director's interpretation, and that's the first invocation category, which permits the presumption to be invoked upon proof that a chest X-ray, biopsy, or autopsy establishes the existence of pneumoconiosis. Viewed in isolation, the singular there, the reference to a chest X-ray, might seem to support the Court of Appeals' view of the regulations. In fact, seen in context, the language strongly supports the director's interpretation. The language of that invocation category is taken directly, verbatim, from the 1972 regulations of the Social Security Administration dealing with black lung claims filed prior to July of 1973. The consistent interpretation of that exact same language is that the miner must prove the fact in question by a preponderance of all the evidence in that category. The reason for that is that the regulation requires that the claimant establish the fact in question. It requires that he establish the existence of pneumoconiosis, and that suggests a process of weighing the evidence of weighing all the like-kind evidence and evaluating. The regulation may be inartfully drafted to make that point, but with 6 years of consistent interpretation requiring proof by a preponderance of the evidence, the reincorporation of precisely the same language in the new regulations should have the same effect as that language did in the old regulations. The reference to a chest x-ray...
It also is hard to say it more accurately, isn't it? If you use the plural, the implication would be that even if you showed it by a preponderance, that preponderance would have to consist of more than one chest x-ray.
That's correct, Justice Scalia. The use of the singular makes clear that a chest x-ray may be sufficient to invoke the presumption, but not that it must be in the face of countervailing, more persuasive evidence of the same kind.
Now, does the agency interpret the plural when it's used in the other sections, such as studies, ventilatory studies? Does the preponderance there have to be a preponderance that is composed of more than one study?
No. A single study will suffice to invoke the presumption if...
Very unfortunate, because that is just not consistent with what you've just been saying.
Well, it is consistent insofar as the reference to studies clearly indicates that all existing studies are to be considered and weighed in the process of determining whether, for example, under Category B2, the person has established the existence of a pulmonary impairment, or under Category B3, whether the studies have demonstrated a respiratory disease. And the reference there clearly indicates that there is to be a weighing process and that more than one study can be relevant. But it has been the consistent interpretation of the director that a single study will suffice in the absence of countervailing studies proving the contrary.
Mr. Kellogg, does the true doubt rule that you refer to in the brief apply at the interim presumption stage?
It would apply only at the interim presumption stage. That's correct, Justice O'Connor.
And not at the rebuttal stage?
No, not at the rebuttal stage, because at the rebuttal stage, the burden is all, proof is already on the mine owner to rebut the presumption. The true doubt rule only comes into play when the burden is on the miner and the evidence is in equipoise. If the burden is on the mine owner...
Well, how can you say in one breath that there's a burden of persuasion by a preponderance and yet have the true doubt rule?
Well, the true doubt rule...
And where do we find the true doubt rule?
The true doubt rule is published in the Federal Register accompanying the interim regulations in a discussion of the rebuttal provisions. It is an attempt by the director to implement Congress's intent to make benefits liberally available, to recognize that there are certain difficulties in proving pneumoconiosis through medical evidence. And Congress made it fairly clear that they wanted the benefit of the doubt to be given to the miners, and the true doubt rule is an attempt to implement that. However, I would stress that no issues are foreclosed by that. It merely allows the burden to shift to the mine owner on rebuttal, and all issues are open on rebuttal. Justice Scalia asked earlier how the rebuttal mechanism works, whether if, for example, by showing that ventilatory studies establish the existence of impairment, then autopsy evidence would be admissible on rebuttal. It would indeed be admissible on rebuttal under the B4 category, which allows the mine owner to prove that the miner does not have pneumoconiosis.
Well, I see. But not to prove that he does, you can't use to prove he doesn't have a respiratory or pulmonary disease.
You cannot prove that by virtue of the same sort
that
of
in
evidence.
In one category of respiratory disease, it comes to the same.
That's correct. Pneumoconiosis and a respiratory disease are not one and the same thing, and they are kept distinct for purposes of the rebuttal categories.
Let me just be sure I understand that. You're saying the rebuttal could be used to prove he did not have a pneumonia, the black lung disease itself,
that could not be used to refute the conclusion that there was some chronic respiratory and pulmonary disease. Is that what you're saying?
It would depend on which invocation category was used.
Well, it depends on number two.
Ventilatory
studies establish the presence of a chronic respiratory or pulmonary disease. That's been established, and the presumption, therefore, is triggered. Is that right?
That's correct.
Now, having triggered the presumption, may they offer evidence that tends to disprove that narrow fact that there was the presence of such a disease?
Yes, they can. They cannot offer more pulmonary studies to show that he doesn't. In other words, all the pulmonary studies will have had to have been considered and weighed at the invocation stage. But all evidence relevant to whether the person has a pulmonary impairment, for example, the opinions of a doctor who has examined the minor, as well as blood gas studies, would be admissible.
Why wouldn't the doctor's opinion be admissible at the preliminary stage to show that the studies do not, in fact, establish the conclusion because doctors don't interpret them that way? Just as in reading x-rays, the distinction between the x-ray and the interpretation of the x-ray. The x-ray doesn't establish it unless the doctor, the sum opinion of all those who've looked at it, at least the preponderance of that view, supports that conclusion.
Well, because the A2 invocation category relies on specific values. Tests are given specific values, and if the minor meets those values in a reliable test, then the category is invoked, provided there are not other tests of the same sort which preclude invocation under that category. The Court has no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Kellogg. We'll hear now from you, Mr. Lowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. If it may please the Court, the petitioner asserts that the administrating agency's interpretation of the invocation provision at 203 is reasonable and entitled to substantial deference. The controlling rule in this matter is whether the administrative interpretation be given substantial deference is whether it's plainly erroneous or inconsistent with the regulation or clearly frustrates the statutory mandate. The Fourth Circuit, in reviewing the director's interpretation of the regulation, found that the agency's interpretation renders the regulation internally inconsistent and is plainly erroneous. The Fourth Circuit gave a clear and common sense ruling to 203A, finding that a coal miner who shows that he has been employed in coal mining employment for 10 years will have the benefit of a presumption that he suffers from pneumoconiosis and is permanently disabled from that disease if he shows a chest x-ray and a reasoned medical opinion under A1 and A4. They found that the clear reading of that regulation shows that you have to produce only one single piece of evidence. As to A2 and A3 on ventilatory studies and blood gas studies, they found that studies for example, in ventilatory studies, you have to produce three different tests before the quality standards applied in the statute will allow that to be a valid test. So they also found that you only had to produce one breathing study. The petitioner argues that that construction by the Fourth Circuit violates the Black Lung Benefits section at 413B, and that all relevant evidence is not considered at the invocation stage. They state that the legislative history does not say that all relevant evidence must be considered only at the rebuttal stage. And we would argue that the legislative history is silent on that. It doesn't say which stage all relevant evidence is to be considered, but the regulations themselves at 203B states that all relevant evidence shall be considered at B.
Does the presumption that's established in A amount to any more than saying that a tie goes to the claimant? What do you need to overcome the presumption? Any more than showing by a mere preponderance that the presumption is not correct?
Is that all that it takes?
Well, Justice, we're saying that, for example, on X-ray evidence, if...
Just answer that question. You've gone through stage A. The presumption's been established. What does it take under B to upset it, in your view? Just a preponderance of all of the medical evidence?
Yes, the burden...
If that's the case, then, isn't this all a tempest in the teapot? In a teapot, because the agency is saying, anyway, that the tie goes to the claimant. What's the name of the rule
True doubt rule.
So what different? Well, you know, what is all this about?
Well, the problem is they speak of the true doubt rule. I've heard of it. I've never seen it apply. The true doubt rule is when everything is exactly equal, then the doubt goes to the claimant.
Which amounts to saying there's a presumption that the claimant wins. So you have what you're seeking if you have the true doubt rule, no matter how you come out on this quibble between A and B.
Well, the problem is who carries the burden. The problem that we're finding at the administrative law judge level is a coal miner is treated by his treating physician, who might have ordered one or two X-rays, determined that he has a disease, and does not continue granting or ordering X-rays. It's not necessary. But at the time of the hearing, the coal operator will come in and have sent that X-ray to 10 or 12 different doctors and have 10 or 12 negative readings. So at that time, when they're looking to see under A1 who wins, it does not become who has the best evidence, who has the quality of evidence. It becomes a numbers game. And under claimants, attorneys have begun to call it the numbers game. We believe that by invoking with just one piece of evidence then takes the burden off of the coal miner to produce all this substantial amount of evidence. It then puts the burden upon the coal operator or the director to rebut those presumptions. And at that point, as the Fourth Circuit had ruled in reviewing all the relevant evidence, then the court looks at everything that the coal company has put in. And using the director's position, where they say that all like-kind evidence will be looked at A1 in the invocation stage, but then when you go to rebuttal, it cannot be used again. It clearly shows what the Fourth Circuit says is under their interpretation, the rebuttal stage is superfluous. In that, take, for example, the X-rays. If you weigh all the X-rays and the administrative law judge finds that the invocation is invoked at A1, then there's no way that they can rebut that the person suffers from pneumoconiosis because under their definition, in B, they cannot reweigh the X-ray reports. Even a doctor's opinion cannot reweigh the X-ray reports. So it shows that the Fourth Circuit is right in that the rebuttal is superfluous. It conflicts or violates 203B in that 203B directly says that all relevant evidence shall be considered. And I would also suggest that in that case it makes the presumption irrebuttable. Now the basic reason that the Fourth Circuit believe that it is correct is because of the legislative history. I don't believe that it's in conflict that this is an unusual piece of legislation. Congress has singled out victims of one industry to develop a program that would benefit them from a disease that they derived from that industry. Congress intended the program to be extremely liberal. They intended that, for the most part, that the burden be upon the code operator or the director. And under the circuit court's construction on this regulation, the miner can raise the presumption of totally disabling pneumoconiosis with a minimum of evidence. Then the burden of persuasion is shifted to the director or the code operator to go forward and produce the evidence where they are in a better position to do that. The procedure avoids placing on the minor, who can at least afford it, the burden of responding at least initially to a plethora of medical evidence more easily generated by the operator. And again, that's in what we call the numbers game. The code operator has the ability, by going out and contacting doctor and report after report, to completely overwhelm the coal miner. And the director's interpretation of this regulation allows that to happen. It completely wipes out the remedial intention of the legislation of Congress. As far as the APA Act applying, we find it interesting that on one hand the petitioner would ask that you follow the director's interpretation of the regulations, but he does not accept the director's interpretation that the APA does not apply. But at any rate, believe that the section which incorporates the APA in the Black Lung Act, 30 U.S.C. 932A, specifically states that it may be excluded by regulations of the Secretary.
And regulations excluded?
Sir?
Which regulations excluded?
We would state that under A, that the A and B show what you have to produce for the persuasion to be shifted to the coal operator or the director. And then under B, with all relevant evidence to be considered, it sets forth a showing that all evidence or the preponderance of the evidence rule will then be applied. So before any decision or final decision is made by an arbitrator, in this case administrative law judge, the preponderance evidence is applied. The federal respondent cites this court's case of NLRB versus Transportation Management for that proposition, that under Section 7C of the Administrative Procedures Act, the question is that before an agency's decision is made, that the preponderance of the evidence be weighed. And in here, that does not necessarily mean that it has to be at the invocation stage. The invocation stage is to determine who will carry the burden of proof. If it is shifted, then the evidence is, all the evidence is weighed under the preponderance of the evidence standard, but that burden is upon the code operator or the director.
Is your position that a biopsy in A1 means just a single biopsy? What about A2? Does ventilatory studies mean more than one?
It means one study, Judge Justice, but...
But I thought you're urging, I mean, it seems to me that the foundation of your argument is the literal language of the statute that says a chest rentgenogram means a, simply one, you're saying. But A2 says ventilatory studies. Now, if you're going to be literal, ventilatory studies means more than one.
Well, but under the context of the regulation, it takes three studies to make one. It's a complicated process. Apparently, they put them through three tests, and you have to submit the results of the three tests and the tracings from the three tests, or it will not be accepted. That is one ventilatory study. So the Fourth Circuit, and I would agree, saying studies just means that you have three studies, but that only makes up one ventilatory studies under the regulations. The same thing for blood gas studies. If you've ever seen a blood gas study, it has values and numbers, just probably 15, 20, that all combine to make up that one blood gas study, which you apply under the charts under A2 and A3 to see if you invoke the presumption. In conclusion,
if the claimant fails to invoke the presumption, he still isn't, he isn't through, is he? All he is, all he means that he still has got a claim if he wants to proceed under the statute, I suppose.
Well, no, Justice, I would disagree in that that's the basic threshold. If they cannot produce enough evidence to invoke the presumption, then therefore you would not go any further. If you cannot produce one single X-ray that would show you you suffer from pneumoconiosis, then apparently you don't have any X-rays. What I'm saying is what the Fourth Circuit's interpretation that the minimal amount of evidence you would have to prove is so low that I believe if you could not even prove that, that your claim would not go any further because you would not have any evidence at all.
Well, isn't there any other way to prove you've got the disease?
Not under 203A. You can X-ray.
Well, that just goes to whether the presumption is invoked.
But under 203, those are the only things that you can offer to prove that you suffer from pneumoconiosis and that you're disabled.
Well, I was just reading the government's footnote 3. If a claimant is unable to invoke the presumption or the presumption is invoked and rebutted, the claimant may nonetheless attempt to establish eligibility in either of two other ways. And it goes on to tell them what it is. So you suggest that really this is the whole ballgame.
There are other regulations you can turn to, but if you can't get it here, I don't think in reality you're going to get it at all. Usually the last paragraph of the administrative law judge's opinion say we've considered the evidence under such and such section and such and such section. But if you can't produce enough under the Fourth Circuit's interpretation to invoke the presumptions under Section A, I do not believe that you're going to qualify for any of the other regulatory provisions. In conclusion, I would ask that you adopt the interpretation of the Fourth Circuit, and that the Fourth Circuit has given a common sense reading to 20 CFR 727.203 A and B, and they have reviewed the legislation and interpreted that legislative history to give the coal miner the remedial nature of the act that they intended.
Before you sit down, may I ask you to comment one of your opponents emphasized the word establish in the regulation. A chest X-ray or biopsy so establishes the existence of pneumoconiosis. Now, do you take the word establish to mean constitutes some evidence tending to prove? That's what it is.
I would take that to mean that the X-ray, based upon the standard that the X-ray has to be in, which is 1/0 is the first step to show that you have pneumoconiosis. I would take that to mean that that X-ray shows or proves that you have pneumoconiosis, that it's not negative.
Even if there are 10 other X-rays that show, support the contrary conclusion?
It supports the contrary. It's their position that your presumption is invoked, and then, unlike the director and not being able to look at any other X-ray, we believe that under B, you look at all of the evidence then and determine if in the administrative law judge's opinion, those other 9 X-rays show that you do not have pneumoconiosis.
So you're saying, I thought I understood some of this before. I mean, you're saying that the one isolated piece of evidence establishes a presumption that there is the disease.
Yes.
And in addition, establishes the presumption of causal connection and total disability and all the rest.
Yes, sir.
And it performs two functions under your view. Under their view, it performs only the second function because you have proved the fact in order to be entitled to the presumption.
That's correct.
And you think the word establish bears your reading. I have difficulty with that. I'm just looking at the language. This is all I'm doing right now.
I would think established means prove and does not set forth a burden of proof of preponderance of the evidence as the director thinks it established.
But do you agree with your opponent's reading of the word established when you're talking about rebuttal?
No, I do not agree. I think it means the same thing in rebuttal, but in the rebuttal phase,
win with just some evidence then?
203B says in adjudicating a claim under this subpart, all relevant evidence shall be considered. And I think under B, that is where the preponderance of the evidence is established in the head of that subpart. It tells you at this point you are now to consider all the relevant evidence in the record. And I don't think it has anything to do with the word established. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Law. Mr. Solomons, you have 1 minute remaining.
Although it's not terribly relevant to the case, I'd like to clear up one misconception about mine operators overwhelming the records with evidence in these cases. In order to generate evidence, you have to produce the claimant. The claimant simply does not have to come and take as many examinations or chest x-rays or tests as we want him to. The claimant is not required to do that, and the administrative law judges can certainly protect them from that, and they do.
8 or 10 different doctors.
Yes, that's right. They can do that.
Without the claimant's consent.
The claimant can do the same thing, and the Labor Department will pay for it, or if the claimant wins, then we pay for it. I think that with respect to the discussion of the singular and plural usages of the in the invocation portion of the interim presumption, that may not be really where the critical question lies. I think the critical question lies in connection with the rest of what it says. For example, a reference to an X-ray is not an inaccurate reference if that X-ray is the most credible and reliable piece of evidence or X-ray evidence in the record. That certainly can establish the claimant has pneumoconiosis.
Thank you, Mr. Solomons. The case is submitted. We'll hear argument.